Unipgakpa Suli Kuliap Yukta.
Let's tell legends and stories.
Ungibadlta. Let's all tell stories.
Kanamjilta Kuliratlu. Let's tell legends and stories.
Welcome to this episode of Let's Tell Legends and Stories. This week's story comes from the Nunatsiak newspaper in Nunavut, Canada. In March of 1999, Inuit writer Rachel A. Kitswelik wrote a series of columns called The Problem of Sedna, through which she told the story of the Northern Sea Guardian, known by many names in many cultures. Marjorie Tabone narrates.
There exists across the Arctic a special myth, a story that in its multitudinous forms epitomizes the very wellspring of Inuit fears and our awe of the elements. It is a myth that is fun and ferocious, that joins the past with the present, that can elicit primal dread even in today's jaded times. This is the story of Nulealuk, or Nversi, the woman below the waves. She is not a goddess, but rather a special creature of fear and tragedy. Once there lived a beautiful girl who dwelt along the shore with her mother and father. She loved her parents dearly, but this very virtue was at once her downfall. When she came of age, her parents realized that it was time that their daughter had a mate. The girl was resistant, however. She knew that having a husband would force her to move away from her parents, a prospect she dreaded. Time and again, the parents arranged to introduce their daughter to prospective suitors, fine young hunters of high skill. She rejected all of them, citing dubious reasons. This one's clothes were sewn funny. This one's sled was too short. The frustration of the parents was exceeded only by the girl's own obstinacy, so that in time the parents resigned themselves to the idea that their daughter would never marry. Consequently, they were overjoyed when one sunny day a handsome youth rode into their camp. The stranger's clothes and tools were of the finest craftsmanship, and his dogs were robust and numerous. Without hesitation, he asked for their daughter as his bride, and for once, the finicky girl seemed smitten with him. In that same day, the two rode away as man and wife. The parents were very pleased. Over the hills and across the ice, through storms and blinding sunlight, the young couple rode for days on end. During this time, the husband would say little, so that the girl grew increasingly concerned as each day crept by. Yet, whenever she pressed her new husband for their destination, he would cryptically answer, "Home." Such answers gnawed at the girl. But her fears were allayed when the youth reined his dogs in at the edge of a strange and wind-swept coast. Far in the distance, over fitful waters, she could barely see a small island on the horizon. Her husband wordlessly gestured toward a small umak, a boat, waiting near the shore. Reticent, yet fearing the wrath of her husband, she scurried toward the craft and silently climbed inside. Within moments, her husband had also climbed in and was rowing them across the darkening waters. For some hours he rowed, while hideous birds swirled and screamed overhead. The island loomed on the horizon. Eventually, the tiny Umar approached the edge of that island. With its stark contours and stones that stood like brooding sentries over the patches of hideous gray-green lichens. Near the center of that isle, on the highest ground, lay a singular oddity. A blackened hut that squatted like some fetid carcass among numerous piles of ancient bones and refuse. And as the girl, her husband leading her onward, approached that loathsome hovel that she knew could only be intended as her new home and wedding bed, she suddenly found herself unable to proceed, pausing in sheer revulsion. It was then that her husband, sensing her horror, wheeled about to regard her. Without a reason to maintain the masquerade, he stripped away his hood and goggles, revealing not the face of any handsome youth, a hunter and husband, but only the nightmare features of a hateful Dongnak, twisting and leering from the depths of the dwarfish and malformed mass that served as a head. And as the spirit reached out its arms to gather her up in its matrimonial embrace, the parentless girl screamed and screamed her despair in futile breaths that were swept up and lost upon the uncaring winds. The old man was turning his carving between his leathery thumb and forefinger, inspecting the edges of the antler tip that, at the stubborn coaxing of his blade, had gradually assumed a human face. And as he did so, he sang as his uncles always had. Like a dog's new pup I appeared, from between the ice and the land, vast sea down below. My grandmother and her mother said that I could drink freely, so watch me drink. He noted that, unlike many of his past carvings, whose faces were dour or taciturn, this image was smiling. Of course it was, for he was happy for the first time in many years. His only daughter, a beauty who had refused all suitors until leaving he and his wife in utter despair of her ever having a husband, had finally been swept away by a mysterious young man. A man whose clothes were of the finest make, and whose dogs, the man recalled with a touch of jealousy, were unrivaled for majesty and prowess. At last, his obstinate daughter had married. He smiled, knowing that he would see his daughter and her new husband-in-law within a year or two, along with whatever children they had had during that time. Finally, he and his wife would be grandparents. And although his wife was already missing the girl, the old man knew that the young couples needed time alone together before returning home, and it was nice that he and his wife now had some time to themselves. But the old man's reverie was now being interrupted by the constant swooping of an annoying bird. It was an imokotelek, an Arctic tern, that seemed bent on attacking him. So he set his carving aside and wheeled about to regard the bird more closely. It was because the old man was an ngakok, a shaman, that he immediately recognized that this was no true bird, but, in fact, a spirit that, having assumed the imokotelek's shape, was boorishly trying to get his attention. So he raised himself up and uttered in the Angakuit language, Dausuni, which in that secret tongue meant, smells like a person. That signaled the tern spirit that it had gained the old man's attention, whereupon it hovered low to the ground. What do you want? The old man asked. I have come to warn you, the spirit piped, that the young hunter who last visited your camp was no man at all, but instead a wretched thing who had donned a human skin to deceive you. Your daughter has married a foul spirit, and it has borne her away to its island lair, a place where the light dies, and hope lies as bleached bones upon benighted shores. The old man was shocked, but summoned the wherewithal to ask, And who are you, Dungak, that you are telling me this? I am the enemy, it screeched, of this other spirit, and I witnessed as he forced your daughter into his boat and rowed her to his island. This I am happy to tell you, just as I will be pleased to lead you to this boat, for I am ever eager to assist in confounding my enemy. The old man heeded the tern spirit's advice, and lost no time in gathering together a party of young men to assist him in recovering his daughter. Once he had enlisted the aid of several youths of considerable size and courage, he allowed the tern spirit to guide them over the hills and across the ice, through storms and blinding sunlight. The rescue party journeyed for days on end. Finally, the tern abandoned them at the edge of a dark and sterile shore. Looking out across the waters, the old man sighted a blemish on the horizon, the isle of his son-in-law. There, he knew, he would find his daughter. The man instructed the party to climb into an ancient umak that lay upon the shore, whereupon he climbed in after them. Taking up oars, they rowed with great haste to that horrible island. Their hope was to take the Tungak unaware and to make off with the girl before the spirit noticed anything amiss. The father and youths rowed in silence, none daring to voice the shared fear that the Tungak might attack at the moment they landed. They were soon relieved, however, for when they reached the island, the Tungak was nowhere in sight. A quick search revealed the daughter, who was huddled among some rocks near the shore. Her eyes were wild, her hair ragged and tangled. She had suffered every indignity, she told them, since her abduction, and had seen unnatural things that it was best not to speak of. Her monstrous husband was asleep, she told, a Tungak sleep that is deep and full of evil dreams. The girl was hurriedly ushered into the boat, the rowers instantly taking up the oars. But they had not left the isle far behind when a great cry caught their attention. A sound of malice beyond the powers of any human throat. The father turned, knowing the Tunrak had awakened to the theft of its bride. As the old man watched, the figure on the shore began to twist, its limbs undulating like dying worms, so that the human clothing upon them fell away, revealing a sickening outline of an unconcealed spirit. While the girl cried in fear, her father urged the rowers on to greater speed, for already the Tunrak's body was stretching toward them, its dark snout probing. As the old man watched, consumed with revulsion, the Tunrak took flight, streaming upward, away from the island and toward the boat. In this form, the husband thing pursued them, wiggling through the air as a vast, amorphous shape over the darkening waters. The old man's panic, as he witnessed this spectacle, was near absolute, for he now realized that he had greatly underestimated the Tunrak's power. His mind scrambling with fear, he knew that the spirit would overtake the little Umeak within seconds. Even with the rowers' efforts redoubled, they could not escape. The rowers, however, had anticipated their plight and were unwilling to let themselves fall prey to the Tunrak over some silly girl. As the father watched the Tunrak's steady advance, seemingly memorized with horror, the rowers took action and seized the cowering daughter. The father wheeled about upon hearing the anguished cry of his child and saw that the young men had thrown her overboard. And yet he was paralyzed, watching but lifting no hand in assistance. Even while his daughter begged and pleaded, desperately clinging to the boat in white-knuckled desperation, she would be sacrificed, he knew then, to spare the rest of them. But still the spirit came on, withering through the air with the speed of an arrow, for the girl still clung tightly to the boat. The monster's vengeance would have been wreaked upon them within moments if one of the youths had not lifted his oar high over his head to bring it crashing down upon the girl's knuckles. Immediately, the other rowers followed his example, so that the girl's cries of fear and agony were quickly drowned out by the repeated blows of oars upon her now mangled hands. And still she clung, until at last her hands came apart from under those blows. First the fingertips, then pieces of second digits, the flesh of which disappeared into the waters. And only when all of her fingers were completely gone did she herself fall away from the Umeak. Her father met her gaze at this moment, seeing that her eyes reflected not fear any longer, but only the wisdom that comes with disillusionment and betrayal. And this was the last he saw of his daughter. This gaze that would haunt him ever after. She slid beneath the sea, and rowers carried him home. Yet she did not die, but she would never know her home, or family, or the surface world ever again. The girl had been a beautiful young bride, but she sank to the bottom of the sea, her fingers hacked to pieces by the blows of oars. Remember, in the time before cities and industry, humanity believed in the will. Above even the powers of nature, rivaling the gods and spirits themselves, was the will of a human being. And it was believed that a thought or a word could define reality itself. Like all of humanity at one time or another, ancient Inuit firmly believed that to will something was to make it so. So it is no surprise that a girl of unusual stubbornness could sink below the waves and therein defy death, her severed fingertips transforming themselves into the first seals of the world, her next set of digits transforming into the walruses of the world, and her third and final digits transforming into the whales of the world. As the story has always told, all of the sea's mammalian life sprang from the pieces of this girl's butchered fingers. Similarly, it is no surprise that this girl continued to rule the sea mammals forever after, protecting and sheltering them as though they were her own children. It was the rest of humanity, still dwelling on the surface world, who came eventually to rely upon the sea creatures, so that they were forced, using the Angakuit shamans as agents, to occasionally appease this woman below the waves by doing the one thing she no longer could, comb her hair. Dara, the end.
Thank you for joining us today for Let's Tell Legends and Stories. To listen to this story again, you can visit our website, knom.org. And if you would like to suggest stories, narrate, or share ideas for this program, please contact KNOM by calling 443-5221 or by emailing us at legends@knom.org.